Is good design really worth the money? Hey, welcome to Growing a Fruitful Brand, where we discuss how to create and grow a brand that makes the world a better place for you, your customers, and your employees. I'm Ben Luters, founder and art director of Fruitful Design and Strategy, and this is my business partner and brand strategist, Raj Lula. Raj, is good design really worth all the money?
I mean, if it's not, do we have to keep paying you? I mean, we can save a lot.
Yeah, that's true. This really, you know, I have a lot to do with this question. A lot rides on this question.
This one hits close to home. Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, of course, I think that good design really is worth the money. And there's a handful of reasons why, but I don't want to just make this about subjective things like, Apple products look better, or Coca-Cola essentially invented our modern version of Santa Claus. Today, I kind of want to hit different brands. We'll probably talk about the big guys in a couple of examples, but I want to hit different brands and give actual kind of business cases for why good design is worth the money.
Sounds like a great plan. Let's just dive right in.
Before we started recording, Ben, I posed this hypothetical question to you where I said, hey, if you had to stand before God and tell him why your job as a designer matters, why, like, justify your existence, how would you do it? And you looked a little terrified at first, but then you said, well, since you bring God into it, and like, tell me what that meant. Like, what were you talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, I love that we start super broad like this. This is like, you know, the most zoomed out version, but I do think it's important. It's probably a good place to start. My mind immediately went to just the beauty in nature all around us, and thinking that just as human beings, I think that we are kind of pre-programmed for beauty. Like, we are just attracted to things that are just visually, pleasing, you know, be it, a romantic partner or just like a beautiful scenery. I have this amazing shot of Iceland on the background of my computer right now. And, you know, I think that given the choice to spend an afternoon hiking in a dusty warehouse without windows and fluorescent lighting, or, fjords of Iceland, I think that most of us would probably choose the latter. And I think that's because beauty really does matter to us. You know, we want to be surrounded by things that that are beautiful. And so there's kind of an inherent thing there. And so I think it's the same thing when it comes to, you know, products and services. There's a lot of options out there in just about anything. In fact, we're kind of overloaded with what people are calling decision anxiety or decision fatigue. There's so many brands, there's so many products, there's so many, an infinite amount of choices. And so a way to really stand out and call to someone is through design. And I use kind of design and beauty kind of interchangeably here, because I think when I'm talking about good design, I'm inherently inferring beautiful design in some way. You know, it could be, you know, through, humorful design that's very human stuff, but there's still like an inherent, I think, beauty to that, something attractional to that that helps it stand out.
Yeah. So let's talk about that word beauty for a second. Does beauty have to mean pretty?
Yeah. And that's why I started to caveat it. Like, no, I don't think so. I think that there is, it definitely can encompass pretty, but I think that even things that, you know, like I was saying a second ago, you know, through humor or through something kind of like almost silly, it's still connecting with like something inherently human and something attractional that we're, you know, attracted to. But I do think that there is like, maybe pretty isn't the right describing word, but like a harmony of things, right? Like a harmonious arrangement of things, whether it be how the colors and the textures and the fonts and the imagery kind of all works together. It needs to kind of tell a beautiful, consistent, harmonious story, even if it's, you know, it might, maybe sometimes for certain industries, for certain products, et cetera, it might be, you know, louder or crazier or more juvenile or irreverent or something like that. I still think there needs to be this like inherent, you know, beauty in it, kind of like a beauty in the mess or the chaos even. Because there are definitely art styles, design styles that are, you know, brutalist or, you know, not what we would consider, you know, pretty. But I think even in some of those, you can find a human beauty that kind of tells a story or connects with a certain demographic. And so, yeah, I know this is getting really broad and philosophical, and maybe we should have some slides to go with this. But, but yeah, did I kind of?
Yeah, hit no, that? I mean, I think I'm sitting here surrounded by objects that I would consider to be beautiful. Like I've got a Yeti, you know, double walled thermos sitting here. Mm-hmm. I've got a, you know, fountain pen that you gave me actually. I've got a, you know, a box cutter that is, really, really well designed. It's got this great, like grippy texture right here. So you don't slip and cut yourself and it folds down really well. And so like those things are all beautifully designed, but they're not pretty. In fact, I would say that very few things on this desk are necessarily pretty. And I think, you know, maybe even taking it a step further, when we talk about pretty, at least the way that I probably receive that word, we're generally talking about things that are maybe kind of classically or traditionally defined as feminine, you know, like things that are subtle and airy and light and soft and, you know, kind of all of those things. And something can be beautiful without being pretty. Like anybody who's ever held a really well-designed tool, or even like, you know, our MacBooks. I know I said we weren't going to talk about Apple all day, but, you know, like the way that, I mean, this computer is heavy and it's metal. And I don't think anybody would say, you know, necessarily that this is classically pretty. But it is, you know, but it is beautiful.
I think that's interesting. I, you know, wasn't expecting to get into like gender stereotypes necessarily in this podcast, but I had a conversation with one of my kids recently. I'm trying to remember how it came up, but I think I used the word beautiful to maybe describe one of my boys or some aspect of something they did. I can't remember what exactly it was. And they were like, no, it has to be handsome. You can't call me beautiful. You can't whatever. And, you know, what came to mind is, you know, I think John Lennon had a song for his son, Beautiful Boy. One of our clients was a church called Beautiful Savior. You know, you can use these words in this way. But I also was thinking about that picture of a beautiful landscape. And someone might describe a nature landscape as pretty. Oh, that was a pretty sunset. That's a pretty mountain. Mm-hmm. You could say that. But if you were to like zoom in on any one of the details of the rugged rocks of those mountains or whatever, maybe pretty wouldn't be the best word to describe it. But some, you know, sometimes the harmony or the assemblage of lots of different things can create, you know, other outcomes that you would use different words to describe. Sorry, I could go on here, but
I know we're in the dangerous territory of just like letting you geek out about this all day, but
no, we're going to change this to an episode about beauty, I guess.
But that's actually why I wanted to talk about this topic, was because, you know, there are certain people that we would love to work with. And for me, one of those types of people is somebody who just inherently gets, or even maybe wants to be convinced about the role that design plays in their business. And so kind of moving to a little bit more concrete version of, we're going to still stick with this values idea, but moving to a more concrete kind of business oriented reason for beauty, I want you to picture, you know, the different main streets in, you know, we live in Omaha. So if you're listening here, then picture any of the main streets here, Dodge Street, Pacific Street, Maple Street, Center, you know, L Street, whichever. And think about when you drive down those places or even the interstate and you see signs. And I think that generally we would agree that the better looking those signs are, you can use the word beautiful or not, but the, you know, if they're well maintained, if they have logos that look like they were designed in the last even 20 years, you know, that the areas around them are clean, all those things, you think that you're in a better part of town, and you're more likely to stop, spend money there, stay for a little bit. And, you know, don't get me wrong, there's something beautiful about the vintage aesthetic, but I think it usually takes 40 to 50 years for that aesthetic to become beautiful. And so there's there's a good 20 to 30 years there in the middle where you are just dragging down the neighborhood. If you don't keep your sign up, if you don't, you know, modernize your logo, all those things, I actually think you're better off from a business case, you know, keeping up, doing, you know, keeping your brand fresh, all those things every 7 to 10 years. And then if you want to 40 years from now, do a fully retro rebrand and go, hey, this is our roots as a company. This is where we came from. And that's a really classic thing. Or sometimes even farther. I've seen people go back 100 years and say, hey, this is really the roots of our company. But even then, they don't, it's not like they just take an old letterhead and just photocopy just that little part and go and put that, you know, as their sign on their building. They still freshen it up. They like modernize the lines and clean it up a little bit. Those can be really successful, but it takes a long time for a vintage brand to become valuable. And most businesses don't last that long. So go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Raj, as you're saying that, I think one of the reasons too, why, you know, some of those retro logos, you know, work so well, it's not just because, you know, this, the trends come back around, and there's a cyclical nature to some of that stuff, sure, right? Sometimes it's like, oh man, it's too soon after this style went out of style for this to be cool again, but give me 10 or 20 years. I think there, part of the reason why some of those things have come back and come back so strong is if you go back far enough, you're going back into a time where people really invested in the beauty and the handcraftedness and the expertise of a brand, and even the signage too. Because like, I agree, there's like, if you have a sign that's like 10 or 20 years old, you probably need to get a new one because they're just not made the same way. But like some of like the old, like, you know, signs that were you know, created on brick wall, you know, painted on brick walls, and you know, crafted out of, you know, metal and stuff like that, can actually have a really awesome kind of patina, but it's because they really invested in how it was designed and made back then. I think is one of the reasons why if you go further back, things tend to be a little bit better. But,
well,
you know,
yeah, I also think, Ben, I mean, if we dig into that a little bit more, like those ones that you're talking about that age really well, typically they only age well if they are maintained over time.
That's true.
And so that means that business existed long enough that it was and was successful enough over that amount of time. I think the things that kind of give us the ick are like, you know, when a sign is yellowed or fading, and, you know, the windows start to peel, the tint on the windows starts to peel off, and like it just starts to look like failure, you know. If we're honest, it looks like this business is failing. And so then we start to associate those styles with failure, even if they're the same styles as the business across town that's maintaining its property really, really well and all those things. But eventually, across that 20, 30, 40 years, the businesses that were not able to maintain die off. They're replaced by new properties or, you know, new businesses who bring in new styles. And so then I think part of the reason those trends do come back around is you go, hey, the only companies with black letter logos or you know, calligraphy logos or whatever that still exist are really successful because they've been around for 100 years. And so we start to equate those styles with success, but it takes a generation or so. It takes us long enough to go, oh, people who used to invest in that way are now successful, so we want to emulate that. But when you're in that messy middle, you go, everybody kind of looks like this, and half of them are failing. And so then you do something new for a while, and you go, well, everybody looks like this, and, you know, not even everybody, the new cool ones look like this and they're pretty successful. Then other people jump onto that train. Half of them are failing, and it's going to take a generation for that design to come back. I think that, you know, again, from a business case, this is why design matters, because it shows which part of that life cycle you're in. And you want to be associated with a healthy life cycle, either harkening back to history of success or keeping up with an understanding of the times that things are, that you know what's going to work for this era.
Roger, are you saying that we should judge a book by its cover?
I do have a book back here that you should, in fact, judge by its cover.
I have your book. Now that I'm a book cover designer, I take that comment very personally. But no, I actually do think that, you know, when people say, you know, don't judge a book by its cover, I've always kind of been like, well, that cover is kind of, it's the gateway, you know. If like, are you going to want to be seen, you know, walking around with an atrocious looking book cover? But there's an attractional quality, and I think most publishers would tell you that, you know, really investing in a cover that jumps off the rack, that jumps off the page, you know, the web page, and really stands out. I think it is actually really important, and I think it relates to what you were talking about when it comes to physical signage. I was just, you were talking about fading signage. I'm not going to say the establishment, but I was at an establishment here in town, and I was trying to find it, and the sign had completely faded to where you could not read the sign. They bought such a cheap sign that out of such a cheap material and cheap printing, it was obviously not for all the elements, that you could not read the name on the sign. And I know that this sign, I remember when it was put up, we'll put it that way. It was definitely in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years this sign went up. And so that's you know, really, really unhelpful, because, you know, signs are important. They help us know where we're supposed to be going, if we're in the right place. And so I think investing in your brand image, whether it be your book cover, whether it be your sign, or your digital sign of your website, your logo, all that stuff, I think it really, really speaks volumes about what you think about beauty.
Yeah. And I think that comes to an entire brand experience as well. Like, you know, I think of when you walk into a lot of independent stores, independent bookstores, independent coffee shops, and I'm not necessarily talking about anybody in particular in town, but especially if you visit another town and you walk into the local place and the carpet kind of smells weird and they're, you know, the paint on the walls is faded. And, you know, like you immediately get an impression that one of two things is true. Either we're so successful that we don't have to care. You know, it's just the way that it is. Like, you know, there is no other coffee shop in town. You can deal with the fact that the barista is picking their nose and then making your drink. Like, it's just the way that it is. Or the other thing is saying, look, we are struggling and we can't afford a nice enough experience for you. And and so we apologize. But we may or may not be here next week. So, you know, sorry. Neither one of those is a good thing. Like what I want to walk into a business and experience is I want to walk into a business and go, wow, this smells great. It looks great. It looks like they were expecting company. It looks like they were expecting me to be here and that they are really desirous of earning my business. Mm-hmm. That's the experience that I want from an entirely branded experience. So not just, you know, fonts and colors and logos on the walls and all those kinds of things, but the entire branded experience should be designed with the expectation that you're going to have visitors and that people are, you know, welcome there and that you really, really want their business. That shows a hunger and an attitude in the business that is the kind of thing that keeps you successful over the long term. We probably need to keep moving to other things in this world of design, because I do want to get to very specific business use cases for good design. One of those that just came up this week, as soon as I mentioned it before we started recording, you knew exactly what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. There was this story about a company called Liquid Death that They're a water company. It doesn't sound like it, of course. It's a liquid death. Water is kind of the opposite of that. But they're I can't say bottled water company because it's actually canned water. They have cans of water that have like a skull on it and this black lettering that looks like a beer can, essentially. It kind of reminds me of like Modelo or some of the classic beer cans. And I've gotten them. I want to say maybe they served it at Big Omaha one year, but you were saying they serve it down at the Steelhouse venue. You know, so it's got a little rock and roll quality to it. And the article that we saw this week said that Liquid Death has a greater social following than all of the other prominent water brands combined. So you take Evian, Aquafina, Dasani, all those folks, and combine them. Their social audience is smaller than Liquid Death's. What Liquid Death did is they took water, probably the most common thing on Earth. There's more water than there is land on this planet. And they put it in a prettier package, in a can instead of a bottle, and then they made it look cool.
Yeah.
And now that company is worth $1.4 billion. They sell beer cans that don't even have beer in them, basically.
I was telling Raj, my 12-year-old son went to a concert at the Steelhouse, and he came home with a can of Liquid Death, and he felt like a rock star, and he felt like he was getting away with something that was naughty a little bit, with a skull on it and everything. And it's a cool brand. Like, you can understand why people resonate with it. And I actually think Liquid Death, from a branding perspective, is a good example of what we were talking about earlier, where, in the whole brand, with the name, with some of their advertising, with even the illustration on it, it's irreverent, it's ironic, it's maybe not pretty, but it definitely has beautiful elements to it. I mean, the lettering itself is very beautiful, the rendering of the illustration on the can and some of the other things, and it tells a whole story, and it definitely stands out in that world of that it's in, of water. And the thing that Raj didn't tell you is they do have more followers than all those other water brands combined, but they only have 200 followers, because who follows water brand? I think Evian has like 20 followers now. They haven't done a whole lot with – no, just kidding. But – oh, jeez. Oh, that's awesome.
In talking about this, about Liquid Death, the idea here is that having great design can begin to build a culture around your brand. Having great design can begin to build a culture around your brand. Now, I want to be 100% clear that having great design is not going to redeem a bad product. You know,
right.
I was just watching the show Inventing Anna that talks about this, fake German heiress who kind of fooled all of New York society. And she was friends with the Fyre Festival people. And the Fyre Festival people did pretty decent with branding and really well with marketing. And that thing was an utter disaster, if you remember. And they had people sleeping in FEMA tents and eating, cheese sandwiches.
That documentary is worth watching. The Fyre one. That one is
rough. And so let's all say, you can't put lipstick on a pig. Like, if it's not a good product to start with, it's not going to help. But water is a good product. It keeps people alive. You can even call it Liquid Death. But then the design begins to build a community around it of people who go, hey, as humans, we also have to drink water, but we don't want to feel like we're in, the French, Alps or whatever. If the Alps even go through France, I don't know. But the point,
we need to get out more.
Yeah, we don't want to feel fancy drinking this water. We want to feel rock and roll drinking this water. And it worked. They took a product that was great. Water has to be good to start with. And it can't, I will say, I've had Liquid Death. It doesn't taste weird, which is probably the number one off-putting thing for me with packaged water. And I will say too, boxed water tried to do a similar thing. They're like, what if we did something besides, a bottle, because it's more sustainable. But to be honest, boxed water for me, it had that elementary school, paper milk carton thing where it just doesn't feel good touching your mouth. And
you don't like that, huh? I've noticed Raj never drinking his milk from a carton. I noticed that. He's just not a cardboard carton guy.
I'm also not a fan of the paper straw. I'm sorry, guys.
Oh, I know.
It's not working for me.
I want to be, but...
You know what I'm more than happy to hang with? I'm happy to hang with the biodegradable corn-based straws or whatever. It's fine. I'm cool with it dissolving after the drink is done. I want to save the planet in that way. But a paper straw, a box of water, I'm not going to hang with it. But they had a great product here. Water in a can. Works well. And the branding helped it become a $1.4 billion company, selling one of the most plentiful substances on this planet. Now, of course, a lot of the water on Earth is salt water, but we're not going to get into that. So you can grow a culture around your brand. Another company that's done this really, really well, Ben, we're about to take a flight next week, is Southwest. What are some things that you love about
Southwest?
What are some things you love about Southwest's design experience?
Oh man, yeah. There's a lot of different things. For one thing, I think Southwest is a great example. I wouldn't say that Southwest is necessarily my favorite logo, the heart. But one thing I will say about it is it's very different. It's like a very differentiated brand. It really stands out. Like in general, you brand an airplane company, you're gonna want to have these like aerodynamic, like swoopy kind of shapes. These like kind of chevrons
like
and exactly like. Those things are kind of obvious and classic, but Southwest, it just feels different from the colors, the symbol, the really bold kind of stable font and modern font. I think it's just a very it just stands out. It's just like, oh, there's something different here. And then that kind of piques your curiosity about like, oh, what's going to be different about my experience? Are they going to do things differently when we, get in? And I think that's true about Southwest. So Southwest is a kind of a different kind of an airline. And almost everything that they do is like just a little bit different than everyone else. And so it's not necessarily going to be fancier or better. It's not like necessarily going to be, premium, but they are going to take a unique and fun, clever, and different approach in like everything they do.
And I totally agree with that. Yeah, because having the heart, even though it may not be your favorite thing in the world, if you were to ask somebody which airline says that they love you, you would probably say Southwest first.
Exactly.
And it's like. And which airline do you think is going to be most likely to destroy your bags or lose your bags? You're probably not going to say Southwest first.
Right.
And now I will say one thing that's really interesting with them, just because I don't want there to be a whole raft of people coming to see us to get heart logos, because like, well, we want to be known as the accounting firm that loves you. One thing that's interesting about their case is that they actually started at an airport where the airfield was called Love Field. And so... and the airport code, I believe, was LUV. And so,
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
oh, man,
so that
Raj,
has
I
a
love
lot,
this.
That has a lot more to do with why the logo is a heart, and I think in their case, it's really, really justified. It speaks to the company's history. It speaks to their attitude towards the employees. Like, it's a really deeply thought out brand, and I would not necessarily recommend that like really on the nose approach to everybody else. For them, they get away with it because of where they come from. So let's talk about Southwest for a second again, because I wanted to, make the business case for better design. Southwest started as a regional airline that served only three cities. In fact, some of their napkins, talking about design elements, some of their napkins that they serve with drinks actually has a mock-up of the original, business plan, which was drawn on the back of a napkin.
It's like a triangle.
As a triangle of three cities and showing like, hey, we're going to be a small airline that serves these three cities. And their app experience is really great as well. Their rewards program, all of those things, they do a lot to really make your experience great. Even the design of the seats themselves, higher end than a lot of other seats used to be, getting rid of economy and first class and just going, hey, if you're flying domestic, everybody gets a little bit wider seat, and they're all going to be leather. That's more common now, But that was not the case a long time ago. You used to have weird seats that were really small in economy and were made out of cloth and felt like, you know, weird bus, you know, seats if you've ever taken a bus trip for a while. And Southwest said, no, we're kind of upgrading the experience for everybody, wider seats. We're also getting rid of the idea of classes in domestic flights. And it worked. They've become the third largest airline in America. They surpassed United as the third largest airline. And if you think about that, like United, when I grew up, I was watching the Chicago Bulls play. You know, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, all those folks winning 6 championships, and they played at the United Center. Like, oh, yeah. This is the kind of cultural place that United has held in our mindset. And Southwest has overcome them, has overtaken them to be the third largest airline. And then, of course, we have American and Delta ahead of them as mainstays. But, you know, if you ask people which airline loves them more, you know, American, Delta, or Southwest, Delta maybe has a case because they really invested in customer service and experience. But American's not even, I don't think, in that conversation.
No.
Anybody from American is welcome to give me a free flight and prove me wrong. But
yeah, that's right. We'll do a whole another episode where we recant all of this if you do that. But yeah, like I think one of the things about Southwest, which is similar to Liquid Death, Raj, is that because of all this, Southwest has super fans. It has people that, you know what I mean? Like they only fly Southwest and they're super excited about it, and like it just becomes a part of their identity and a part of, you know, their the brands that they love and support and follow. And I think that is kind of the power of investing in some of these things and differentiation, beauty, and design.
There's a designer out of Southern California. I think I'm gonna mess up his name, but I think it's Andrew. I think it's Hochrottle is how you pronounce his last name. Andrew, I apologize if I mispronounced it. It's got some C's and H's in there. But he loved Southwest so much that he started doing this design project where he was like, I'm going to design swag for Southwest until they let me. Every time I take a Southwest flight, I'm going to design swag for them until they let me design swag for them. And sure enough, they ended up doing a limited edition thing with him, and it was all very like retro 80s, and it was very hip, a little too hip for me personally because I don't think I could rock it. But I mean, you said super fans. I know that Southwest recently featured, they had a gal who was making purses out of recycled seat leather. Which I'm really hoping is like fully sanitized because I know there's a lot of folks in those seats. But
they forgot to wash them.
Like you said, there are these people who are really, really passionate about the brands. I've even seen runway shows that feature dresses and suits and stuff that are made out of recycled materials from Southwest planes and you know, Southwest uniforms and everything. So
I think Raj might be a Southwest super fan.
You know, the thing is, like, to me, Southwest is like the Target of airlines. You know, it's like, are there better things? Like, is there a Neiman Marcus? Is there, I don't even shop at fancy enough stores to name a ton of them. But yeah, the Von Mars, all those. Like, are there the higher ends? Absolutely. And would I love to fly, you know, first class to Europe or whatever? 100%. However, in the world that I live in, the airline that makes the most sense and is the best value for the money is absolutely Southwest. I've flown the other lower cost carriers. In fact, most people wouldn't even consider Southwest a low cost carrier anymore because you have like, you know, Spirit and JetBlue and those kinds of things that are definitely below Southwest especially in terms of experience. But yeah, Southwest, I think, is the Target of it. It's not the Walmart. I think those would be your JetBlues and those kinds of things. It's not your Neiman Marcus. It's that kind of right size for a lot of people, a Target experience. And hey, if I win the lottery, I might only fly business class, first class, or buy my own plane or whatever. But in the world that I live in, yeah, I mean, I love Southwest. And I'm happy to get reward points and keep flying them all over the place, because that is a, it's a great experience, again, for the money, and that's what I optimize for at this time of my life. Let's talk about how other aspects of design end up impacting, again, the business case for the company, that it's not just subjective. This feels more beautiful. This feels more fun. But how what's another way that the design affects the business case of a company? One of those is user friendliness. Mm. There are a lot of examples where you take something that's kind of a known quantity and you just design it better. We talked about that with Liquid Death in the growing a culture around your brand thing, but not everything deserves a culture kind of. You're like, you know, there's not necessarily, there's products that just are not super sexy. You know, we talk often about our friends over at Thrasher that, you know, redesigned the contractor experience, and they did that really, really well. There was a lot of kind of tech-oriented inspiration for their branding and for their experience. But at the end of the day, basement waterproofing, concrete, all those kinds of things are fairly low-tech things that you need done, but they give you a feeling of a higher-tech experience. Another thing like that is a company that I have grown to admire called Anker. Anker, they took, you know, things like chargers and cables for your phone and your computer, those types of things, and they elevated the design just a little bit. You know, I'd say they're maybe halfway between the gas station cables that you can get that are always overpriced and they break after three charges or whatever. They're probably like halfway between that and Apple's, you know, really shiny brick chargers with the braided cables now, which are wonderful, little magnets that stick really great. They're about halfway between that, halfway between the lowest bargain bin pricing thing and the top end of that. In doing that, in just raising the design value of the product itself, on USB chargers, those types of things. And by the way, USB is a standard that's been around for almost 30 years. And the technology is pretty widely available. I don't even think you have to pay for it because it's a universal standard. So you have to download the specs, you have to make sure you comply with them and all that. But basically anybody, Ben and I could go start Fruitful USB chargers if we really wanted to, because the IP is pretty widely available. So what they did was they changed the experience of buying those things, experience of using those things. And Anker has become a 900 employee company that is worth $22 billion, mainly based on tech peripherals. And if there is a less sexy phrase on earth than tech peripherals, I'm not quite sure what it is. And for Anker, being known as a lower cost alternative to Apple's native products, which, by the way, sometimes aren't always the best. You know, their cases aren't always necessarily the best cases out there for iPhones on the market. There's been a lot of complaint about their new, I can't remember what it's called, the woven fiber or whatever that thing is that they're trying to replace leather with. There's been a lot of complaints about those. So Apple's not always the best place for peripherals. They're almost always the highest priced or near the highest priced for them. And so there was this room in the market for people who didn't want cheap, ugly plastic stuff in their house. And they're like, but we do need to charge our phone in four different rooms because, you know, if we're cooking, we can't have the phone in the bedroom to listen to music or a podcast or whatever. So, you know, need those different chargers in different places. But we don't necessarily want to spend $50 a pop every time we're going to get a charger. Anker changed that experience and is making $22 billion in the process. Ben, do you want to talk about Anker or talk about other brands that you've seen do this where they, like, it's more or less a really common product, but just changing your experience of those things becomes really, really big?
Well, the first thing I wanted to say, Raj, is just that I think a lot of times when we say that something is good design or well designed, we mean that it's user friendly. Like, that's kind of like what people, and it's cool too, because if you remember, Fruitful's tagline used to be friendly design and strategy. Mm-hmm. And part of that was just because, you know, my personality, I think, especially in the early days, just very friendly and really wanted to put out this kind of like, you know, just kind of warm, friendly tone from the website. But some of that kind of came into, like, one of the reasons why that name, that word stuck, was that friendliness, user friendliness, is super, super important. If you can't use a technology or a product, if it's difficult to use, it's the value just plummets, I think. It's more likely they're going to want something to get redesigned. It's not designed well if it's not user friendly. Thinking of like brands that do this well.
A couple that come to mind that I know you like are, I've got this Yeti sitting on my desk, this Yeti cup, Stanley, yeah. That has experienced tremendous growth over the last few years. Now, I will say Stanley is not just about design, though, because yes, those products are really, really well designed. It's a 100-year-old company that has been doing really, really great for a long time. The mug that really took off in the world was a redesign. It was a little bit sleeker. They had a great rebrand, I think. I like the bear with the wings or whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And so, they showed that they're interested in modernizing. But the thing that really took off with them was that there was a video that went viral of this lady who had one of those cups. Her car, like, had some major malfunction. The car caught on fire. And when she was rescuing her whatever stuff was salvageable from it, she pulled her Stanley cup out, and it still had ice in the thing. Like, it was so well insulated that there was still ice in her drink. And Stanley, really smart. They hired a really, really clever CEO. They gave her a new cup, maybe a few new cups, and they bought her a new car. And and then that was kind of the beginning of their virality. And it's just gone to an insane place now. But I will say that they are paying a lot of attention to, colors that are popular, all those things, and they're capitalizing on that experience with design. But, Yeti, Stanley, those are some things that are really common products, right? Like, we're drinking vessels that have, you could use just about anything. You get cheap swag, mugs and all those things all the time. What makes some of these companies different? Like, why do we gravitate towards some instead of others?
Yeah, I mean, I think, some of those, especially when you're talking about those physical products, I think it's like how it feels in your hand and just like how, you say these things are simple, but like, I guess I don't have it on me right now, but I have a Yeti water bottle that with a special lid that has the handle in it, but also has a screw-off lid and a drinking spout that just feels good on my mouth. If you have something that's too wide mouth sometimes for me, I just spill water all over myself.
I'm going to be wearing that drink, yep.
Yeah, especially if I'm driving or something like that. And it's funny that you bring up the Stanley, these popular Stanley mugs, because, I bought one of those giant Stanley mugs for my wife, one of the trendy ones. And I don't like actually how it's designed. And I don't know if she does either, because they're super top heavy, actually, especially if a little toddler. It's so easy for these things to knock over, and they have like 5 gallons of water in them. and they don't seal on top. So also, if it falls over, it's just going to start pouring out because it has an open straw. There's nothing to like close it. And so I've kind of mixed thoughts about that. I think it was a bold design in that it does just carry so much water. So I think a lot of people want to up their water intake, or want to at least appear that they're upping their water intake. That's a big part of the design, is that, hey, and it will fit in your cup holder. That's why it's so top heavy. So I think in that way, it is designed well for what it's trying to achieve. Here's, I think they especially targeted like moms and stuff like that, women who want to up their hydration, but they're busy and they're driving here and there, and they want to be able to sip it as they go, so with the straw, and it can fit in the cup holder, which is hard. My Yeti does not fit in the cup holder, and so I actually have a
my
cup
Nalgene
holder.
Doesn't either.
The Nalgene wouldn't either. I invested in a cup holder expander that kind of sits on top of my cup holder, and like screws in there, so that I can have even my Fellow mug, which I love these Fellow mugs, and this message is brought to you by Fellow mug, but Fellow the cool thing about them from a design perspective is that they are a double walled insulated experience. They look like a Bluetooth speaker as well. Like,
yeah, they're really sleek. Yep.
Yeah, the design is nice. But the thing that the design standout for them is that it's a ceramic interior. And so they claim that that helps improve the taste. It's going to taste like you're drinking coffee from a ceramic mug, and it's not going to be metal. I don't know how metally, things really taste in the Yeti. I don't know how much of that's in my mind, but they claim that this is a better taste. I think it does taste good, but how much of that is great marketing? It's hard to know. But
you're just really metal to start with, so I mean,
that's right. I'm a little
that's why you can't tell metal. The difference.
You know, I just want to say real quickly on the drinkware. It's funny, we've talked a lot about drinking in this episode, Liquid Death, and these different drinking vessels. I think one of the really smart things about these things is drinking is something that we do every day. And if you have a podcast like we have right here, I'm going to take a swig of something every once in a while. And I think like Liquid Death really capitalized on this too. And that, Joe Rogan, I know, has had those on his podcast, which a lot of people watch, and other people, these things, they're there. And I've seen them talk about them. People are like, what's this? And then they get a chance to kind of talk about it right on the air. And it's just visually sitting there in the corner to add a little bit of interest on their desk or whatever. And I think it's the same thing with these Yetis. It's like you can't, or the Stanleys, you just can't help but notice them. And they're just a big, iconic design that you have to kind of interact with. And it's like when you see, like, my wife, she's like 5'3" and she's carrying this mug that's about the same size as her, it's just like you can't help but notice it. And then once you have one of those, you, especially these Stanleys, you're kind of in a tribe whether you like it or not at that point. Kind of similar to the Southwest thing.
There's a couple of things that makes me think of, because again, we're talking about user friendliness, about how good design makes things more user friendly. I've got this Yeti cup here. This is their, I think their Rambler is what they call it. And I drink my iced tea out of it every morning because I'm not a hot coffee person. Hot take. but my cold absolute take. Favorite thing, and it's probably the smallest component of this, is this little magnet that I'm holding right here.
If
you're not on the
podcast, MagSafe.
but if you're not on the video, I mean, I'm just holding up. It's this little slider that goes right on the top of the cup. Makes this very satisfying. It's a strong magnet. Makes this really satisfying click as it snaps in, and you slide it and you hold the you hold the drink closed. My favorite thing about it is it's really effective as a closure. So it does its job well. You know, you can almost turn the cup upside down and, you know, not spill anything, maybe a couple of drops, but good enough for my use case here. But the other thing I like about it is that it's removable, that they thought through the design of this product so well. You can remove it, set it separately in either the dishwasher or the silverware thing, or we have this rack on top of our dishwasher for knives and that kind of stuff. So we usually put it in there. And you can wash every component of this cup. You can put the cup in the dishwasher. You can put the lid in the dishwasher. But you can separate that thing so there's no gunk that builds up between the little clasp and the top of the thing. So you don't ever get even detergent. Like, I don't even really like, you know, soap getting built up in there. I want that whole thing to be clean. And like Ben said, you know, these are the products that we use every day. I literally use this every day, and I get a little bit sad if I find that it's in the sink and not clean, and it's just like, oh no, I forgot to wash it. And then it's like the day starts out just a little bit sadder because I don't have this good one. I got to use the one with the weird plasticky slider. And honestly, for me, for something I use every day, this is what makes this cup worth 3 to 4 times the price of the mirror cup, which is very, very similar. The outside of the mirror cup is very, very similar, but the mirror lid is nowhere near as good. And I will pay for that magnet over and over and over again. In fact, I'm thinking about ordering some new ones with my personal branding on it, because I just love this cup so much. Talking about those, you know, Ben mentioned products that we use every day. Companies like Purple, that entered the mattress space, you know, it's like, you know, they say you should spend money on things that you use every day. So, or, you know, that you use all day, every day, your chair, your computer, your mattress, you know, you things that you're going to sit in, things that you're going to use all the time, invest in those things because it'll increase your quality of life. So Purple gets into a market where there are established players, you know, you have your Sealy Posturepedics, you have all those kinds of things in that market. You have mattress stores all over the place that nobody knows how they stay in business, might be a front. We don't know. but then you have this direct-to-consumer company that enters the mattress space. They've got a little bit of different technology, cooling, that kind of stuff. But great design, great different experience, and all of a sudden they blow up. They become a major player in the market. This is the kind of thing that I'm talking about. If you make something more user-friendly, if you make it easier, you can order a mattress to your house. Like, right. It comes in a box, and it expands because it's all foam now instead of the springs, all those things, I guess. I don't know that much about mattresses. But, you know, they made it easier. They made it a more user-friendly experience, and they drew a huge fan base because of it. So we talked about how good design can grow a great culture and, you know, make your water company worth $1.4 billion. It can make you the third largest airline. We talked about how user-friendliness can grow Anchor to, you know, 900 employees, $22 billion. Makes Yeti and Stanley, all these other companies, you know, in the race and competitive markets. Last thing I want to talk about, and this will kind of go into, I just want to let Ben riff about some things too, is that good design shows that you're paying attention to the details. And we've talked about this a lot on the podcast. If I ever get known for anything, it'll probably be my phrase that consistency equals trust when it comes to your design, when it comes to your brand. And, you know, there's this frozen yogurt shop in West Omaha that my kids and I frequent. And they've spent tens of thousands of dollars on signage, the branding and signage, and the hyper graphics on the walls, which are those really, really big kind of almost mural-like things that are really hard to install because the vinyl gets all sorts of bubbles in it. They've painted the walls a certain color. They have lighted signs behind plexiglass, all this kind of stuff. Probably giving away too many details. People don't know who I'm talking about. But,
oh, I think I know.
But the thing is that I absolutely can't stand about this is they have a paper sign stuck to the door saying their hours.
Like scotch taped onto the door?
Yeah. and here's the
coming
reason.
Coming off I totally, in one corner, probably.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, probably sticky on the back because some kid put their hand on it and all that. You spend tens of thousands of dollars on designing that experience. And then you stick your hours up on the door with scotch tape. And look, I know why it happened. It happened because you start a business with all the best intentions. You go, hey, we're going to be open from, you know, 11 to 10 every day or whatever. Because 11 in the morning, if you want Froyo, then great. 10 at night, you want Froyo, great. We'll be here for you. And then the world changes around you. COVID happens and people are like, well, we don't have any hours now. Or we have very limited hours or whatever. Or you discover that not that many people eat Froyo in Nebraska in the winter. I do because I'm a champion, but not everybody else does. And so your hours end up changing. But when I see that paper sign, what I see is that a company that has tens of thousands of dollars to invest in the experience of this brand cannot come up with a better solution than a nasty piece of paper taped to the door with scotch tape. It's failing, it's falling down, to show that their hours change sometimes. We couldn't come up with an LED screen. We couldn't come up with one of the millions of other ways to show that our hours sometimes vary by season. And instead, we tape this nasty piece of paper up there. The reason I hate this so much is because it makes me wonder how clean the Froyo machines are.
Right.
Like, if we're... You lured me in with this branded experience. This is not a, you know, mom and pop ice cream shop where, you know, their teenage kid is you know, sitting there on their phone, whatever, You know, he's like, hey, what can I get you? And you wonder if this dude's washed his hands. No, this is a franchise. It's a company that has invested so much in this experience. And you got me there saying, hey, we're professionals and we're going to deliver the best Froyo experience to you and your kids. And then when I see that sign, I go, but they cut corners somewhere. And that makes me worry. The spoons are branded, but they didn't invest in the sign on the door. So that makes me go, ugh. Okay, is it safe? Now, we haven't gotten food poisoned yet, and I'm really thankful for that because I love Froyo. But
now I'm just thinking about Froyo.
Yeah. details matter so much in your experience for your customers. So, Ben, I just want to ask you, like, what are some things that designers see when it comes to those details that the average person would not see?
Yeah, that's a good question, Raj. Before we start recording, Raj referred to this as the barcode on the back of the book design kind of a thing. And what he means when he says that is, you know, I've done a lot of portfolio reviews for young designers, and a common project is like designing a book design mock-up. And something that I've seen so many times with young designers is they'll you know, design a decent book cover design, but they'll forget to put a barcode on the back of the book, and the other like little publishing details and stuff like that would be on a typical back cover of a book, and even sometimes some of the details you'd have on a spine. Understanding that these are completely imaginary projects that don't matter, and that's usually what a student will say to me is like, well, I don't have a barcode for it. And that's not really the point, though. It's like you are trying to design something that looks real and looks convincing and looks believable. It's not like who checks the barcode on the back of the book to know if it's real. You know, the person checking you out at the store ever interacts with that, and it's a machine when that happens. So you can fool someone pretty easy on that.
Yeah. It's like, and I've seen you do this many, many times, like screenshot, you know, a famous book, you know, a bestseller, and just screenshot the barcode and throw it on the back of your book. No one is going to know, because like you said, no one is scanning this one. But what it does show is that you thought about whether or not there's space for the barcode. You thought about, you know, having this kind of white block at the bottom of an otherwise colorful book cover. How does that balance with the other elements? There's some work that has to go into it. And if you don't even leave any room for it all, think about if your designer did this. You said, hey, design me a book cover, and they designed it, and they put, you know, a great quote from, you know, Donald Miller or whoever down in the bottom right-hand corner of the book, and the rest is filled with beautiful synopsis details, lots of five-star reviews, whatever. It's all the way down the back of your book. And then you send it to print, and the printer goes, I need room for the barcode. So then what? What are you going to do? You're going to have to delete content now. You're going to have to remove one of those awesome ratings or reviews or one of the great endorsements from a popular author because your designer failed you, did not give you room for the barcode, which is a necessary component of the design. It's one of the things that kind of just bugs us as it goes, hey, we didn't actually think this all the way through.
I think another one, Raj, that comes to mind, we've got a couple more here, but you know, one that's like maybe more obvious for people would be like inconsistent fonts throughout a brand, right? But I don't mean that like, because I understand that there are some times where, you know, someone has to use like a substitute font on a website, but they try to get one and match it close enough. I'm talking about when they're using a font that just wouldn't even make sense with your brand. They weren't even thinking about it, you know, whether it's like a hobo font, or that's the name of a font, or papyrus, or Comic Sans or something like that on a sign on the door, like something that's just like, this is clashing with kind of everything else that you're seeing around you in this experience, and is so clearly outside of the realm of this brand.
Ben, I'm going to challenge this one. I'm going to be the devil's advocate here and go, okay, do fonts actually matter? Like, or is that just a nerdy design thing that you go, well, I don't like it because I know how to do it right. Like, show me, like, tell me why does this actually matter?
No, I mean, I think it really does matter. Obviously, I mean, I know I'm paid to say that, but I think also, like, you know, there's only so many there's only so many visual assets that we use to tell a consistent brand story. There's only so many things, right? It's like you've got images, so like photos slash illustrations, and icons would be kind of in there. You've got colors and textures, and you've got your fonts. So it's like there's not like a ton when it comes to like your website, your business card. It's an opportunity to tell a consistent story. And you can have, and we recommend that people have multiple fonts that work together. And it comes back to that word at the beginning of the episode about harmony. Like we pick fonts that harmoniously work together, which is actually a lot harder than people think. Oh, this is 100%. Why you hire a designer, by the way, because yeah. I do this. I was doing this yesterday and it's hard for me. It's hard for me sometimes to like find fonts that actually complement each other and then also complement your logo. Cause
yeah.
Some people think that, hey, just use the font that you use in the logo for our headline. And that's not always the best choice. For yeah, one thing, it's 100%. Not always a font that's in your logo. Sometimes, and oftentimes, especially if you're working with us, that's a custom typeface that was created just for your logo type. Yeah. And sometimes it can kind of clash if you have exactly the same type style in your logo and your headline.
It can also be too much.
Yeah.
You know, if you wouldn't want Coca-Cola to write everything in the swoopy Coca-Cola.
I mean, right. Like, you wouldn't want everything written in the fruitful font behind Raj right now.
Can you imagine if the nutrition facts on the back were like nutrition facts? You know?
Dude, that would actually be fun. I'm sure that on like a terrible font, free font website like DaFont, there's probably a Coca-Cola font I could download. And it would be fun to mock up. Like a can of Coca-Cola with everything in the Coca-Cola font. No, that'd be a terrible choice. And so, yeah, picking fonts that harmoniously complement your logo, that harmoniously complement the other fonts in that brand, and then work with the images, with the icons, with the, like, it's really kind of this, it's this dance that kind of has to happen for it all to kind of work. And I know that you're like, well, Ben, you have to say that because you're a designer, you're paid to do this, this is your job, you know, et cetera. And that's, of course, part of it. But I think that even non-designers, though, can tell when something feels, they might not be able to know why, but that when they see something that's completely off, if you were to see, you know, again, a really, you know, a papyrus level font. Just we've joked about it before. Like, let's say you go to the new whatever Apple product coming out, and then the headline is in papyrus. It would really be unsettling. It would feel like, oh crap, what's going on? Something's wrong. Something's wrong with Apple. Some people may not even be able to articulate why at first, and that's okay because that's not the world they live in. But it'd just be like, this doesn't feel right to me, and I'm not sure why exactly. And the other one that came to mind, because I just mentioned it offhand, was icons.
Well, hang on. Sorry, real fast. as much as I was playing devil's advocate about the fonts thing, I actually really love fonts.
And Raj is a big font nerd.
and one of the reasons why is, you know, if you open up a Microsoft Word document and you use that font Calibri, which is the, at least was the standard one that was on Microsoft Word for like, you know, 10, 15 years, it was Times New Roman before that.
Yeah.
If you did that and then you typed everything, and I mean everything in that font, then life would be really boring. You know, like, you know, I've got, you know, my novel sitting in the corner behind me here. Imagine if that was in the Microsoft Word font. Imagine if the, you know, if the jewelry store logo was in the Microsoft Word font. Right. Imagine if the menu at the five-star restaurant was in the Microsoft Word font. I mean, I could just keep going on and on and on. Imagine if Coca-Cola logo, all those things. I've never, ever gotten anything from the Apple store that had the Calibri font anywhere on it. And that's a way of them saying, we're not Microsoft. We are not that company. We make these other choices. And And they do it really well, really consistently. And I'm talking even down to the email receipts that they send you are never in the Microsoft Word font. The user manuals are never in the Microsoft Word font. They have chosen, in fact, they had a font specifically designed for them that's a take on, it's a take on Helvetica. But they specifically tweaked even a very good, famous font for their own purposes so that they have a specific designed experience. I know we're not talking about Apple this whole time, but they have a specific designed experience that when you see a logo, I'm looking at a product right now. It's got that made for iPhone, made for iPad logo on it. It's not even this product isn't even made by them, but that font's correct. And if it weren't, if that even made for iPhone, made for iPad thing were in the Microsoft Word font, I'd go, this is not going to work. This product is not correct.
Raj has a really good eye for fonts, though. I will say you are above average in your eye for that. But I love that we're talking about fonts because, and I'm glad you paused here for a minute because we really could do a whole episode or two on the power of fonts because, you know, we all, I think, would agree that the written word is so important, right? Like what your website says, I would hope anyone listening to this would understand it really matters what you say. And we get people that hire us just to help them with the words and they don't have the money or the time or they have some other resource for the design sometimes or they'll try it themselves. But like people will understand that they need help crafting the right words for things and sometimes more willing to invest in that. But fonts are it's like the dressing that you put on the words. And it's crazy how much personality. I mean, even for a non-design person, I challenge you to look at some logos, some signs as you walk down the street, as you drive down the street, and think about the personality, the life, just the vigor that can be communicated in the typefaces chosen for different logos, for different things around you. First of all, we're surrounded by letters. I mean, from directional signage to a program that we're holding when we're at the theater. I mean, we are surrounded by these things. And I know for non-design folks that's something that you just kind of, it's not on the forefront of your mind. But it is crazy how much is communicated in the lines. And as someone who is surrounded by custom hand lettering every day and does a lot of it himself, I was just working on a hand lettered piece earlier this week and tweaking all of the little like points and getting the thicknesses right and the angles right. And I was actually consulting with a couple other hand lettering artists to try to finesse it to get it just right. And it's crazy how much goes in there and how much history those things are based on, you know, different actual brush pens and, you know, there's an amazing, amazing history there that a lot of people, understandably don't know about or don't think about. But what they do get to interact with is the end result. And so, that is like a very, very crucial part of the equation of creating a consistent brand presence, but also a brand presence that feels the way that it should. Because I am always blown away by, I was doing this again with a client yesterday where I'm trying to figure out what is the right headline font for their brand. We just finished their logo. And so I wanted something that wasn't exactly the same, but complemented it. And I'm like going through all these different fonts. I'm looking online. I'm looking at what I have at the ready on my computer. And it is just crazy how different one little phrase will look from one font to another and how it just feels. Yep. And you have to think of so many things. The brand I'm working on is one for a preschool. And that's its own thing. Like immediately, you know, you might think, oh, a preschool. So you want to have something that looks really kind of like sloppy and hand drawn.
Just use that
like
crayon one.
Use that crayon one. But like, no, you want to have something that's actually very proper and very you know, because you don't want to show that, hey, we're sloppy and we're going to teach your kids the wrong way to write. Yeah. And so it's like you have to, but you want it still to be friendly and approachable. You don't want it to look too hard and or sophisticated or mature. And so these are the kind of things that designers, I think about all the time, is yeah. like we have to communicate a bunch of different things at the same time with very limited assets. How are we going to do it? And so, you know, again, I know that this is the world that I live in. And so I'm, you know, I'm a little bit biased. But at the same time, I think that these things are really crucial. You only have yeah. so many different tools at your disposal. And they do have to kind of work in this harmonious dance, or you might confuse people. And you might create a conflict in your brand image.
Yeah, I mean, I love what you challenge people to do, like walk around and think about fonts. I was thinking about walking around. There's an open air mall around here, and if you even just like pick one category, even of
yeah.
Of store or of even of items, and like if you think about what the difference in just fonts communicates between. Let's pick pants, right? So it's like between Gap and Levi Strauss and Old Navy, Madewell, J. Crew. You know, if you can picture these logos in your mind, yeah. you know, it's like these are all communicating different value positions. You know, could even throw in like Wrangler into those. You know,
Wrangler,
there's,
yeah.
You know, there's so many different. We're talking just about pants. But you'd be able to identify for each of those what they're trying to accomplish more or less entirely through their fonts. Because if you think about especially like retail spaces, yeah, you get, you know, Gap has the blue square around that font, but you don't get a lot of real estate to differentiate yourself and call to your core audience. It's generally a, you know, what they call channel letter sign popped on the front of your store that is going to be mostly letters, and
yeah.
you have that amount of time to make an impression and go, you should walk in this store and buy something from me. The same thing is true no matter what kind of business you're in, whether it's medical, whether it's business services, whether you're primarily selling online or selling in person. That happens all the time, and fonts really do matter. I know we're talking about like minute details here, but one of the things I wanted to kind of just call out in this whole episode is that I'm just honestly sick of this idea that design is a luxury, you know, or that design is easy and replaceable. Look, right. I've seen the AI generated logos. Most of them are pretty generic. And even if you do get a good one out of it, doing the work of fonts that work together, what font should you use yeah. in your social post now? What font should your user manual be? What font should your documents, your invoices, your receipts, all of those things be? Yes, you may be able to cut corners in small places and go, okay, I had AI help me generate this logo. But can AI, you know, Ben started talking about icons. Like, can AI make sure that your icon line weights are the same
yeah,
as the line weights,
say, yeah.
line weights in your logos? Can AI make sure that, you know, historically, this font goes well with this font? All those things. We're going to see advances in those yeah. technologies. But I can tell you that the reason why Ben's going to have a job for the next 20 years or however long he decides to work is because he's going to be able to look at it and know whether or not the AI is following the rules that are going to get you to a more successful mm-hmm. business case. Or he's going to know whether or not the thing that the computer created is going to make you look like you've got a paper sign taped to your door that tells people you didn't pay attention to the details. And unless you spend 20, 30, 40 years studying the rules of design yourself, you probably don't have it. I don't have it. Like I work yeah. next to Ben every day, and I know a lot because I've been exposed to this for the last 10, 15 years. But I don't know as much as he does because I don't have to sit there every day pushing fonts next to each other and going, why doesn't this look right? And mm-hmm. that kind of human expertise is really, really difficult to replace. That's why I'm not worried about his job. He will use new tools to help you in the next 20 years, 100%.
Yeah.
And he might even be able to make 100 logos a year with new technologies. But he will still have work to do, because we all are looking for those advantages in our business that design can provide. You know, we just talked about so many use cases. We didn't even get to one of my favorites.
What's that?
Hyundai and Kia, about how, you know, they have really, really changed their image. They went from being one of the least respected car brands in America when they launched, I think it was the 80s, because their cars would fall apart, to consistently ranking at the top of quality. You know, the Kia Telluride got, you know, the best large SUV a couple years ago when it came out in 2020. The Ioniq 5, the Hyundai's electric car, consistently ranks above the Tesla Model X as the best, you know, kind of crossover small SUV electric vehicle, above Tesla. Elon can get all the headlines he wants about buying Twitter and all that kind of nonsense, but Hyundai is just working quietly in the background. They made this car that's really cool. It's got these little LEDs that kind of look almost like retro video game kind of stuff, and people are,
I think Raj wants a new car.
Oh, I do. I if anybody at Hyundai is listening, I will absolutely take an Ioniq 5. But,
well, since you brought it up, though, yeah. Raj, you know, like, I think, and I know we've joked about it before, but, you know, Kia did, they invest in this big rebrand, and, you know, it, some people found it hard to read the three letters, and they read K and like a backwards N instead of K-I-A. But in that, I remember when that came out, it was really clear to me instantly that Kia was like, they wanted to elevate the image of their brand. Whereas if you look at their previous logo, it looks very kind of, it looks cheap in a lot of ways. Yeah. Intentionally so. If you look up the original Kia logo, it's like, yeah, Kia, that's the cheap one. That's like kind of cheap. It looks kind of juvenile. It doesn't look like a serious, elegant, sophisticated car brand. And that, I think, was true. That's what they wanted to be. And now it's like, no, Kia like wants to look more like, you know, high art, high sophistication. They want to look, so even if their logo maybe is hard to read for some folks, that is, they want to kind of hit a completely different demographic, and they did that through the power of design.
Yeah, and even making a mistake, if it even was a mistake, it netted something like 30 million new searches for KN cars. The funny thing, the year that that new logo was released, and the great thing about that for them was that they literally just started buying Google AdWords against the search term KN cars.
Right, search for KN cars, and you'll see that now.
It's so smart. Yeah, Kia pops up, and then the second thing that pops us up, at least for us, was Kelly Blue Book's article of like, what is KN cars, and immediately links them to Kia, which is, you know, from an SEO perspective, getting a high ranking site like Kelly Blue Book to write an article that links to you. It's called a backlink. Yeah. Is such a smart it ended up working really well for them. And so it's hard to even call it a mistake, because I don't think it is. And the other thing, you know, Ben and I were talking about this, is that I think that part of the reason that we see KN on that logo, if you do, is because a lot of us just grew up in the 90s when Nine Inch Nails was a band that just happened to have a backwards N that looked kind of similar. And I think the younger generation probably does not have as hard of a time seeing Kia in the logo because they just know it. And so even that small, like, little liability of making that change, do I think that they could have addressed it by making a little notch in the A or something like that?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that would be an easy thing to fix, maybe.
Yeah, design things that are, there's certainly other choices you can make there. But, I'd take 30 million new searches to my website easily any day. And I'd be happy to buy some keywords against that kind of popularity if people are looking for me. But the other reason, though, that they were looking for me is because the design of the cars themselves really changed. You're starting to see these Tellurides out there. You're starting to see improvements across the rest of their line. The Kia EV9 that's coming out soon is this three-row electric SUV. Again, it's going to be one of the most popular things that comes out because they're just beautifully, beautifully designed cars, and they understand their market. They've worked really, really hard to earn the trust of their customers, and it's paying off.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like we think that good design is worth the investment.
I mean, you're right. This is either going to be a really long episode or it could be two episodes. But yeah, I just want to challenge you hopefully you already knew this. Hopefully you already knew that investing in design actually does have a return on investment. But if you didn't, I hope that today you learned some things to show you that this is not just an aesthetic choice. This is not just a, frou-frou, luxury in your business. Now, don't get me wrong. Everybody starts somewhere. There are times when you cannot afford, a thoroughly designed experience. I was talking about that paper sign taped to the door. I get it. I get that sometimes that's the best that we can do because we can't pay to replace the vinyl on the windows every time, or we can't afford an LED sign that we can change. I totally get those kinds of things happening. But even in the paper sign taped to the door, you can make other choices, right? You can make choices like, what if you use a suction cup and a frame? If it has to be a paper sign, can you afford a suction cup and a frame? Or whatever the fact may be, you can elevate the experience for your customer so it shows that you really desire their business and that you really value them, and that equates in more business, more dollars every time. Thanks for joining us today on Growing a Fruitful Brand. If you found today's show helpful, don't forget to subscribe and consider sharing it with someone who might also enjoy it.
And if you'd like to work with Fruitful on a branding, website, or messaging project of your own, you can always reach out on our website, fruitful.design.
Until next time, don't forget to grow something good.
You jerk.